So without further ado, a very warm welcome. Thank you for joining us today. To this two-day conference, Deep Time and Crisis. A very warm welcome to our speakers, especially those who have come a long way to be with us, but also those who have accompanied us in the discussions leading to this exhibition and generously shared their thoughts, intuitions, and knowledge without which we would not have possibly been able to realize this project in its present form. As with the exhibition, the contributions to our conference are not primarily, at least in the narrower sense, scholarly contributions to the expanding field of Einstein studies, but rather are informed by the writings of Carl Einstein in multiple ways, as well as by other interwar authors and artists, in order to open up broader issues. We have a rather wide range of contributions thematically in the coming 2 days, which speak about different aspects of the crisis between the world wars. We wanted Deep Time and Crisis to focus on an admittedly far-ranging aspect of the project, Neolithic Childhood, Art in a False Present, circa 1930. The role that conceptualizations of time and temporality and the critique of predominant ideas of history and historiography have played in the artistic and intellectual production of the 1920s and 30s. And then we wanted to sound out possible reverberations and parallels of that critique in the present. The latter, I hope, will surface on occasion in our discussions, for the parallels are as obvious as they resist simplification. Deep time, one could say, flashes up in a moment of danger. And that much is true, certainly, of the planetary dangers of our present, where natural history in the form of climate change threatens to intrude into the anthropological matrix of human history as an effect unleashed by the Industrial Revolution, a condition also referred to as the Anthropocene. But it is no coincidence that some researchers argue that it is not the industrial but the Neolithic revolution with the dawn of agriculture that should be recognized as the beginning of the Anthropocene, initiating a process that is now about to merely reach a geological tipping point. The end of the last ice age marks the beginning of both the geological epoch of the Holocene and the transition from the Paleo to the Neolithic. Ever since that transition, the conditions for life remained almost unchanged, and in this period of relative stability, most of what we usually refer to as history with a capital H unfolded, that is, the history of civilizations. But the stable background against which their expansion took place is about to crumble and transform with uncertain outcomes, resulting in a rather literal uncertainty regarding the ground we stand on and the milieu we inhabit. And it is not least this ontological uncertainty that short-circuits a modern catastrophic present with that threshold of history some 10,000 years ago. Invoking deep time with Carl Einstein in the sign of a phrase coined by him in relation to the work of Jean Hans Arp, however, also means in a broader sense to refer to deep time as a speculative realm where the distinction between natural history and human history becomes altogether uncertain or reconfigured, and with it, a whole other set of dualistic conceptions and subject-object relations pertaining to the abstractions governing instrumental reason, whose origins have variously been traced, justly or unjustly, to the beginning of sedentary life, domestication, architecture, urbanization, and the institutionalization of inequality. Einstein derived some key conceptual oppositions of his thinking from that threshold of civilizational history, from the confrontation of hunter-gatherer forms with those of settlers. Carl Einstein was primarily the thinker of the metamorphotic revolt, and it is in this sense that he had a tendency to undermine and invert, as various anarchist historiographers have done since, standard civilizational narratives with their emphasis on progress and stability. For him, the rise of settler civilizations instigated what he called in the Brack book a reduction, a constriction, even an atrophy of the real, rather than its increment or enrichment. They were characterized by tectonic form shields and repetitive patterns seeking to overcome death and the passage of time, and by what he called a canon of hallucinations, binding together collectives increasingly in the form of organized religion. But Einstein was not simply a romantic anarchist for whom a lost primitive golden age of plenty existed in the manner of a kip figure, complementary to the adversary's version of a brute past gloriously overcome by civilization, like the two sides of a coin. His notion of the metamorphic and of the real was situated beyond and below such binaries, and there was never a kip figure or dichotomy that he didn't subject to a process of Formverschleifung, a materialist degeneration of form. And I think it is in this vein that we have to understand his notion of a Neolithic childhood, which sits on neither side of the binary only, not on the side of the tectonic nor on the side of the processual and the hallucinatory ascribed to the animistic hunter-gatherers, but which points at their co-presence and vital battles, however asymmetrically, in every given present. The Neolithic may also, in fact, have been a time yet before or beyond such binaries. The history of social formations during the long Neolithic revolution, up until the Bronze Age, is still subject to contestation and significant revisions in the light of new archaeological findings. But a certain progress-oriented bias in the narrative ordering of history is gradually giving way to an understanding of the complexity and sophistication of Neolithic societies. Hence, historically speaking, there is no longer a justification to speak of a Neolithic childhood as a developmental stage of humanity. Neolithic humans in all respects were our equals. In fact, societies in the Neolithic might have operated with a wider set of organizational possibilities, and there is evidence that several Neolithic cultures might have undermined certain mechanisms of accumulation and institutional hierarchization systematically. And it is in this sense that of a wider set of possibilities that it might make sense to speak of a Neolithic childhood in a transvalued sense. Childhood understood in terms of an ontological opening, in terms of the indeterminacy and expanded mediality of the human and mythopoetic capabilities. Rather than thinking in reified binaries, I believe Einstein's thinking is rather one that typically posits, as we have now seen, one notion of childhood against another in the manner of a carefully calibrated critical difference that at the same time seeks to step out of the spell of mutually co-constitutive opposites. Conceptual abstractions and language inevitably remain caught in the reproduction of binary logic and its inverted mirror effects, but artistic hallucinations lead the way out, beyond and below, to deeper strata. To think of this strata in terms of the archaic is the result of a scission within the present itself, the product of a prohibition on memory and its reconstruction of the plane of emergence that characterizes and perhaps constitutes the patriarchal order of identity. Einstein's mobilization of history was always, I believe, turned against this prohibition as an attempt at the reconstruction and recovery of that milieu of emergence. In language, all that remained was to subject concepts to a process of degeneration that brought about such critical differences and activated such strata, below and beyond the choices and the apparent alternatives of a false present. In other words, Einstein mobilized concepts against concepts in order not only to undo dualist conceptions and how they nurtured the disciplinarization of knowledge, but also to prevent the recourse to pre- or post-dualist conditions to lead to false closures and false reconciliations. Such critical difference is what needs to be recovered in Einstein's thought, as when Gestalt acts against Gestalt, fiction against fiction, formalism against formalism, or function against function, etc. In each case, a difference is marked by Einstein's use of the term. But it is an endangered, precarious difference that language alone ultimately fails to maintain. It can be upheld and recovered in artistic hallucinations, Einstein seems to suggest. But it is also a matter of positing art against art. Insofar art serves such purpose only as a revolt against its own institutionalization and ontological neutralization and fictionalization. Perhaps it is the feeling that we might have today of living in a false present that alerts us to the necessity of such critical differences, and more so, that might alert us to the vital importance that the experiential dimension possesses. Speaking of crisis rather than the continuity of catastrophe today is perhaps only justified when we speak about such endangered critical differences, when we take stock of the abilities of our words and concepts to mobilize and shift the image of history. that such critical differences can at times only be recovered archaeologically is one of the key convictions and motivations behind the multi-year project Kanonfragen here at the HKW, a series wherein Neolithic childhood is a major chapter. In the previous exhibition, entitled Parapolitics, Cultural Freedom and Cold War, one could get a sense how despite or because the fact that the pre-war avant-garde project lay in ruins after 1945, modernism was canonized in a manner of a new antiquity and subsumed in yet another Eurocentric narrative of progress, but at the price of obliterating the scope of its indebtedness to the non-European and its own radical questioning of the status and functions of art. Thus, it might not be enough to correct the Eurocentrism by enlarging just what is allowed into the great halls of the new modernist antiquity, but it is also crucial to recover what remained, in the words of Walter Grasskamp, unbewältigt or unresolved, and therefore projected beyond the limits of the new canonization. We turned to Karl Einstein not merely because of the significant and lasting contribution he made to the prevailing modernist canon and because of the anti-colonial and anti-Eurocentric demands he himself put forward but often failed to live up to, but also in order to recover what the reified modernist and contemporary canon, no matter how much it has righted its wrongs, no matter how inclusive, expanded, and corrected it presents itself, still has tremendous amount of trouble remembering. At least as long as we have not recovered in art the revolt against art, against the disciplinary and indeed ontological partitioning that defines art institutionally and economically. What Einstein demanded of art history in the Handbuch der Kunst, the Manual of Art, namely that it become a vital part of the history of human collectives, thus remains a topical demand. Thank you very much. And at this point, I'd just like to quickly thank the two main organizers of our team who have helped pull this off, Susanne Förster and Dunja Salan, as well as Agnes Wegner and the entire team of the Bereich B, which is in charge of the exhibition program here at the Haus der Kultur und der Welt, as well as the larger team of the house. And I hand over to my colleague and partner in crime, Tom Holert.